Welcome to Walden Pod. I'm your host, Emerson Green. I was recently a guest on the Sentientism podcast. We spoke a little about my personal background, young earth creationism, naturalism and how it's defined, moral realism, ethical intuitionism, divine command theory as a form of moral subjectivism, animal ethics, physicalism, the moral implications of panpsychism, and a couple sources of optimism for the future. So here's my conversation on the Sentientism podcast.
Good morning, Emerson. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Yeah, really good. Really good. Well, thank you for taking the time to join this series of Sentientist Conversations. I was saying before we started, I feel like I already know you because I've listened to your voice or watched your videos so much. But it's the first time we've had a proper conversation beyond the odd Twitter DM chat. So it's great to talk to you. And as you know already, because I'm honored to have you as a subscriber and a listener, this is a series of conversations about what I think of as the two deepest philosophical questions are the most important ones: what's real and what and who matters. I've got an obvious bias because I'm trying to popularize and develop this really simple pluralistic worldview called sentientism, which suggests that we should take a methodologically naturalistic approach to working out what's real using evidence and reason such as far as they'll take us. And when it comes to who matters, the scope of our compassion and our moral consideration, the clue is in the name. We should have compassion or moral consideration for all sentient beings, so all beings that have the capacity to have ideally valenced experiences, suffering and flourishing in particular. But I'm lucky in these conversations to talk to a dazzling array of people, some of whom agree with sentientism and many others who don't. So it'll be fascinating to understand your own philosophical journey and where you've got to on those crazily big questions. But before we start with those, how would you best introduce yourself?
Well, I mean, I have a YouTube channel that's called Emerson Green. And I started a podcast a long time ago. If you'd rather listen over podcasts, I have two podcasts, one called Counter Apologetics and one called Walden Pod. And everything is decentralized like that because it sort of came about piecemeal. Like, I started the religion podcast first, Counter Apologetics, just because I needed an outlet to talk about religion. I was just annoying my girlfriend at the time, my wife now, like, way too much. And, I needed to, like, get all these, thoughts out and to, talk about it with people. And it wasn't even, like, optional. It was something that, like, had to be done because I just needed to talk about this stuff. It was on my mind all the time.
That's fascinating because my wife, who's somewhere behind me here, finds it really annoying that I'm doing a YouTube podcast. But I will make that point to her that if I wasn't talking to the world, you know, my tiny subscriber base about these things, she'd have to be listening to it directly. So, yeah.
I know. Everything that you're saying in these podcasts, she would have to hear in great detail.
Exactly.
So she should, I mean, that's kind of weird. I've heard, because my story, I've heard from other podcasters, like, literally where their wife will be like, "You should start a podcast because I'm tired of hearing about your hobby."
Yeah.
So, I just need, like, a reduction of, like, you know, not 100%, but just, like, maybe a 50% reduction of hearing about the intricacies of philosophy of religion while I'm trying to work. I started off talking about religion and, I can't remember why I started this exactly. I think you just asked, you know, about my life and my work, but, you know, that's, like, so central to my identity, I guess, is, you know, thinking about religion. Religion is just one of the most interesting things you can talk about. It's the intersection of practically everything that I care about, you know, like what we're talking about, ethics, you know, what's real, what matters. But also just, you know, psychology, epistemology, metaphysics, like everything that I find interesting, you know, biology, like everything that I like to think about is going to come up at some point when you're talking about religion. So it's just kind of the intersection of a lot of subjects that I find really fascinating. So, you know, that's how things started off for me. And then eventually I wanted to talk about some other stuff besides religion. You know, like the pretense of the podcast was very narrow. It was like, okay, we're going to set up, like, some apologetic argument and then counter it. And if you want to do something other than that, then I felt like I had to have another podcast. So that's Walden Pod, where I talk about, like, metaphysics of consciousness and just occasionally some other stuff. And after that, I have started uploading those podcast episodes to YouTube. So that's why everything is kind of, you know, decentralized. But Yeah, it started off just with an interest and like a need actually to talk about religion mostly, and then some other issues in philosophy.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And those conversations I find equally fascinating. That's part of the reason I was so keen to have a conversation with you here, because the ideas of religion run through all of these big questions. And of course, the philosophy and the metaphysics of mind do too, because if sentientism is centered on sentience, you know, it's sort of interesting to think about what it might actually be. So we'll run through all of that. So let's move on to this first big question, which I, in a really crazily broad way, say, you know, what's real, or how should we think about what to believe? So for many of my guests, that's a story about whether they grew up originally in quite a sort of naturalistic, maybe scientifically minded context, society, family, or one that was more supernatural, more religious, more spiritual in some sense, and how that side of their thinking has changed over time. So yeah, you can wind the clock back. It would be fascinating to tell your story. And how would you summarize where you are now on that question of epistemology, but I guess also ontology?
Yeah. I was raised in kind of a young earth creationist, literalist Christian household, like an Answers in Genesis type worldview. I'm now an atheist. I have been for like the better part of a decade. Maybe I'm beginning to lean agnostic, but I don't know. So it's interesting coming from that background, because I was, in a sense, kind of sheltered from like science and philosophy. I didn't really know what philosophy was, you know, like I liked philosophical subjects, but I didn't know that that's what it was called. So I went to like an apologetics camp at one point. It's like 2 weeks long and like, you know, dozens and dozens of hours of lectures about, you know, apologetics and all the things that come up. And that was sort of, that's like what started this kind of journey, I guess. Like, I was there already because I was questioning and everything, but it was the first time I had heard the term like epistemology or something. And I'm like, oh, there's a whole like people talking about how we know stuff is like a whole subfield. Like I had no idea anything like that existed, but I was immediately like, whatever that is, I like that.
Yeah. And before that camp, how would you describe the sort of core things that you believed? And were they articles of faith, or in the way that they were described to you, was there some underpinning rationale that was supposed to lead to the faith, or was it just faith?
No, it definitely wasn't just faith. Like Answers in Genesis, if you're familiar with them, like they do try to give, you know, scientific and philosophical arguments for their young earth creationist view. And the thing is, they're not as easily debunked as people would think. It's why a lot of people get involved with debates in them, and then it ends up being like kind of a draw somehow, even though young earth creationism is like one of the like wrongest things that you could like propose about the natural world. Still, like if you're not familiar with their arguments, like you're gonna find yourself kind of bamboozled, I guess, by some of this stuff. Like you have to be familiar with what they actually say. And sometimes you have to learn some like pretty deep philosophy to engage with someone like Jason Lyle, who, you know, is like an informed physicist with a PhD from a real university. Like, you know, they get these people who are young earth creationists who do ultimately believe because of the Bible. You know, like the reason they're even looking into this is because it's scriptural. They're like, they act the way I feel like more Christians kind of should act, where it's like, hey, we've got a book from God, which seems like it might be a better epistemic authority than, you know, what some scientist says, and they're going to say something else 20 years from now and be equally certain that that's, you know, the real truth this time. You know, like a book from God seems like a pretty solid epistemic source, you know, whether it was like inspired or written or whatever. The point is it's divinely, it has divine origins, you know? So that's why they're even looking into the question of how old is the earth, right? But after that, they are trying to make like scientific arguments. And the earth is like, the earth and universe and humanity is really, really, really not 6,000 years old, you know? And it seems kind of trivial to prove that, but I just mean like in a debate setting, it's like harder to, it's harder to argue against than you might think. The core of it was a kind of like biblical worldview. Like the basis of it was ultimately scriptural, but there was still a place for like, you know, scientific argumentation and stuff. But I just wasn't exposed to science more generally. And it is kind of like, I don't want to say paradoxical exactly, but you know, like my mom is a professor at a Christian university. Like, she was just made a full professor, like, in the last couple of weeks. And so it's not like, you know, she has a master's in psychology. She had her own practice for a long time. Like, I'm not trying to say my parents are like, or my family, like, they're stupid or something. Like, they're definitely not, but they just, it's just weird because it's wrong to say they're anti-science or something. You know what I mean? Like, it's not exactly accurate, even though on the surface level, that's a perfectly fine description. Like, yeah, they're anti-science. But when you scratch the surface, it's not like they reject the authority of science, you know, like, they're very concerned with, you know, as is every Answers in Genesis like proponent, like, they're very concerned with making scientific arguments for their view. They're like, they couldn't live with the cognitive dissonance of having a view that they actually thought was in conflict with, like, scientific findings. So yeah, it's a little weird, but it was, like, ultimately biblical, but there was a place for, you know, scientific argumentation, but I was still kind of sheltered from anything to do with, you know, real science for a pretty long time. And in a way, I'm kind of grateful for that because I learned about evolution later and then I was kind of blown away by it, became obsessed with it for a few years because I was like, it was all new to me, you know, so it was a lot more exciting. Like, I wasn't taking it for granted.
So how did that journey happen? Was the apologetics camp, sounds like maybe that was where the cracks first started to appear, because it was the first time you heard it was possible for someone to disagree with the view and learn about ideas like epistemology and so on. So was that where the cracks started to appear, or what was your journey like through moving away from the AIG world?
I mean, the cracks were there. That's why I was sent to the camp.
Right, okay.
So the cracks were...
So it's partly to counter... Yeah, it's partly to be, you know, apologetics to the ways you were already starting to think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So how did that play out?
Well, the cracks formed naturally. I mean, I was thinking about faith and prayer and, you know, the Bible. I was just kind of blown away with how bad the Bible was. Like, just like morally was not that impressive or wise, it seemed to me. And as a book, it was just terrible. It was just like, it caused some like dissonance for me to think that this book had anything to do with like the mind of God, I guess, because it was so bad. Like, it was just like, no one reads the thing. Like even Christians don't really read it. It's not that good of a book, you know, like in literary terms and moral terms, it's just not that good. You have to be like a pretty highly educated person to see merits in the Bible, I think. Like, you know, so like David Bentley Hart, who I really admire, you know, he would just be totally scoffing at what I'm saying right now, that the Bible is so terrible. But it's like, you have to be as educated in like biblical scholarship as David Bentley Hart, I think, to like see the beauty in like the biblical story. Cause if you're just reading it, it's like, this is just not that good. And so that kind of bothered me. You know, the failure of prayer kind of bothered me. It didn't really seem to do anything. I thought that, you know, like my immediate surrounding, like people were really concerned with constantly talking to God, you know, like it wasn't just like a rare thing for God to, you know, speak to you like in a dream or something. Like, it wasn't like this rare once in a lifetime or like once in a decade thing. It was like every moment of every day, God is speaking to you, you know, and that just struck me as totally crazy. It seemed like it was pretty obvious that it's just your own voice and your own intuitions. And you're just kind of saying it's like someone else's. Interestingly, there's this show called Under the Banner of Heaven. It's about Mormons. I wasn't raised Mormon, but it kind of shows, you know, how that can go very, very wrong. Like, one of the main characters is someone who thinks that God is like speaking to him all the time. And it does have all these, it might slip by you if you weren't looking for it, but it really struck me because that's the kind of thing that I was like, I just don't know. I don't know how to put it, but the terrible situations that came up in that TV show, which is based on a book by John Krakauer, it could... Believing that God is constantly speaking to you can obviously lead to that kind of thing. You know, it won't in many cases, but anyway, there were just little things that bothered me, you know, like speaking to God, you know, the kind of laying on of hands and like healing people, you know, that didn't seem to work very well. You know, God only ever seemed to do things that might've happened anyway, or just not that impressive, kind of unverifiable, nothing that was like undeniable. You know, it was all stuff that easily could have been, that we could have been mistaken about. And I don't know. I'm just trying to grab onto like a handful of different things that might have been, you know, kind of under the surface in my teenage mind at the time. But
yeah. And in the conversations I've had, I mean, some of my guests are religious and still are. But for the ones that did move away from a religion, it seems that quite often there's a combination of, you know, the facts and the evidence stuff, right? Incoherences or inconsistencies, or it just doesn't seem to tie up internally or with respect to the outside world. So there's the facts and the evidence stuff. But often, as you hinted at, there's also some moral stuff. You look at this book and go, this deity is described here, doesn't seem like a great moral exemplar based on what I think of as ethical. You hinted at a third potential one, which is literary, maybe, you know, the writing is even that good, right? But it seems like it was a mix. It seems like it was a mix of those things. Yeah.
Oh yeah. But like, imagine you were like, you know, giving a book to humanity and it's like, it's your revelation, you know, you're God and it's your revelation to humanity. Would you start it off with like, and such was born to such and such, he was born to such and such, he was born to such, like you'd want it to open with a bang, I would think.
Yeah,
you
know? It's not
like,
a killer first line, is it really? Yeah.
The New Testament. Yeah. It's just, yeah. But the thing that really got me though, the thing that was one line of continuity from when I started to where I am now is sort of the internal logic of Christianity. Like just the story, I think, doesn't make any sense. It kind of decoheres when you try to fit together all these different doctrines that came about piecemeal over time for different reasons in different historical and theological contexts. And then you try to fit them all together under one roof and it just doesn't work. You know, like the mainstream Christian narrative, I think, is just basically incoherent. Like literally, it is logically contradictory. All these things can't be true. You have to give up some of them or just like radically reinterpret some of them. And these are core things like, you know, God's goodness and love and justice and mercy. And the idea that if you, you know, fail to be a Christian, if you fail to accept the right propositions about how the world works, you're going to burn for all of time. Yeah. Or if you're a really liberal Christian.
Even if you never got to hear of them.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're a really liberal Christian, then those people, you know, all the non-believers will just be annihilated permanently upon death. You know, so it's just like, it's impossible to fit these things together once you try to actually start taking into account, you know, facts about like religious diversity and the kind of involuntariness of some of our religious beliefs, you know, the fact that they're due to different, you know, contingent historical factors, you know, like if some of these Christians who are very quick to mock the kind of argument from like religious diversity, you know, if they were born in India, they would probably be Hindus and then they would be sentenced to eternal conscious torment, according to their view. And they have some extremely weak apologetics for this kind of thing. It's just totally unconvincing. It's they're already committed to this view and they're just trying to make it work. You know, like there's no way that this would be plausible to anyone who's hearing it for the first time. And if you do cast like the slightest skeptical gaze on it, it just falls apart immediately. And you know, anyone can see this except for the people who are just totally totally dogmatized and just unable to see. I mean, the idea of eternal conscious torment, when you try to square that with like a God who's just, for instance, it's literally impossible to do. Like it seems pretty obvious, actually.
Agree. It feels incoherent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So when you went on the apologetics camp, did that paper over some of the cracks, or was that when it opened up, how was it? Was there a light bulb moment, or was it just a gradual realization? And
yeah, I mean, I thought that I was going to go to that camp, and then it's like this will be a part of my testimony someday. I'll be like, yeah, I was an atheist, and then some wise Christian answered all my objections, and then the exact opposite happened. Like I heard the defenses, and I was like, this is the defense, and it kind of I did have sort of like a lightning bolt moment of like, oh, I don't believe in God. Like it sort of went the opposite of how I expected it to go. And yeah, I was like very angry for a while because it felt like I'd been lied to, you know, and kind of misled. I went there because there were these cracks forming, and it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back where I was like, yeah, this is not true. Like, it was very psychologically destabilizing. It was like, you know, kind of central to my life, you know. I didn't want to, I did kind of want to deconvert because I thought it wasn't true, you know, like the dissonance was like too much and I was like, I can't deal with this anymore. But you know, on like a more micro level, I really did not want to deconvert, you know, like it was really like, like it was upsetting, you know. It was like a really, it was like a year long, really painful process. And now if I could choose to believe, I would. Like if I could choose to be a Christian, I would, just for the sake of my mom, basically, because I know she like prays every week that I would like reconvert to Christianity. I know it's like a big cause of distress for not only like my parents, but for other people, you know, who are like family friends and that sort of thing. So it's like, to say that I'm indifferent to it, you know, I just can't go that way, because it's like, oh yeah, I'm totally indifferent to it, but it would make some of the people who I love the most in the world very, very happy if I am, you know, converted. So it's like, yeah, I would like to convert. I would like to believe, but the Christian story doesn't make much sense to me. And even with the versions of Christianity that aren't incoherent, because there are some versions that are not incoherent, they're very fringe, and you'd be called a heretic if you adopted them. But anyway, the reason I'm more agnostic about those forms of Christianity is ultimately because of the kind, degree, and distribution of evil in the world, where, you know, I think Luke Roloff said this on this podcast, actually, where he said, you know, if you're looking out at the world, your first thought is not, oh yeah, this was created by a perfect being, you know, a perfect being of love and goodness. And like, there's of course a moral rationale behind all the evil that I see in the world. Like that is not the natural reaction that you would have to this sort of thing. It's a very morally mixed world. Like the world has a very morally mixed character, and that's just not what you would expect if the foundation of reality was a perfect being. So that has more to do with my non-belief now. Like, yeah, the internal inconsistencies of Christianity and theism generally, and yeah, basically the problem of evil.
Yeah, makes sense. It feels absolutely central. And as you hinted at there, I think when you extend the problem of evil out to think about, you know, wild animal suffering, for example, it just becomes even more egregious in scale, and it becomes much harder to blame human free will for wild animal suffering too. So yeah, I'd echo that. But it's interesting because my own journey away from a religious worldview was much easier, partly because it was much more of a background sort of thing. It wasn't central to who we were and who our society was. Even then, it still took me quite a few years to move away from, but there was no real trauma. Whereas it feels like for you, it was, you know, psychologically difficult and socially difficult in terms of family and society as well. Some powerful social norms that shape and push you in particular directions. And it takes some real sort of intellectual courage to, you know, follow where your head wants to go. And I can only imagine there are countless millions of people who maybe think the way you and I do, but because of those pressures just sort of go along with it, right? And I think the prevalence of atheism, or at least agnosticism, within religious communities is extremely high and often not recognized. But
yeah, including with like pastors, you know, like there's some book called like Caught in the Pulpit, I think, and there are people who sort of lost their faith but who are pastors. It's like they feel like they just can't do it, you know. They can't, like, they're not free to just walk away from it if they were just a normal person or something. And yeah, there are other people not quite in that position, but they have families, you know, they have you know, spouses and kids, and it would be a huge problem if they were to come out of the closet like that. So they just kind of go along with it, or they are just very vague about what they think, or they just lie, you know. And I can understand why they might do that, but, you know, I was fortunate to be in a position where, you know, I was just like a teenager, so I was free to say whatever I wanted. And I was old enough that, and it's not like I would have been kicked out of the house or anything. I know that's a fear for some younger people as well. I've heard that there's a pretty high population of gay homeless teenagers around Salt Lake City because they get kicked out of their house by their like Mormon families. Yeah, so I was never in danger of like that kind of like radical disowning or something like that. But you said intellectual courage. Yeah. Or maybe just like stubbornness and like hard-headedness and just not knowing when to shut your mouth. That could also be part of it. But,
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks for sharing that story. And quite often in these conversations, as you can imagine, and we talk about naturalism or supernaturalism, but we quite often focus on religion because it's such a central and obvious example. But of course, there are many other topics that are relevant to naturalism and supernaturalism as well. And through these conversations, you know, as a total amateur here, and you can put me right on a lot of the philosophy, I quite like the idea of distinguishing between a couple of different forms of naturalism. So one, I guess, is the classic ontological naturalism, where you say, and you've made some great videos on this yourself, where naturalism is just the view that reality is exhausted by the natural world. There's no supernatural stuff. There's no supernatural causality. It's natural. And that can lead you in all sorts of different ways of thinking about what the natural world is, but it's a statement about the nature of reality. And then there's a, if you like, a maybe what might be more open naturalism, which is a methodological naturalism, which says, look, we're going to, instead of using fideism or revelation or some other source of knowledge, we're going to use evidence and reason, acknowledging their limitations, to try and form our credences and beliefs. So you might imagine that a methodological naturalism could still leave you with some openness about the possibility of supernatural stuff existing, but they're sort of distinct. And for me personally, my methodological naturalism leads me to an ontological naturalism. But do you think it's useful to separate those two ideas out? And a part of the reason I'm asking is because it strikes me that there's, for my mind, this methodological naturalism is supposed to try and start from a reasonably neutral point of view and use evidence and reason to form beliefs and credences. Whereas there are others who will use a completely fideistic approach, which says it's just an article of faith. I don't need evidence and reason to support it. It's faith. That's it. And I'm actually quite proud of the fact it's pure faith. But then there's a third approach, which you talked about the Answers in Genesis people doing, which to my mind is almost like a reverse naturalism or a fake naturalism, where you start with a conclusion and then you do use evidence and reason in a selective manner to try and reinforce the thing you've already decided you want to believe. So I should stop rabbiting on, but I find that sort of mix of different methodologies and ontologies quite interesting. I don't know what your thoughts are about.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. I mean, the Answers in Genesis approach could also just be called natural theology, where it's like they do try to use evidence and reason to try to prove their, you know, religious claims about the world. And I think natural theology is, like, you know, unsuccessful, obviously, because I'm an atheist, but, like, yeah, you can use just rational arguments. You can try to start from neutral principles. Like, you don't have to start like the way the Answers in Genesis people do, where it's like, okay, our starting point, our foundation is the Bible, and then we're going to try to do something like natural theology. Like, you can do natural theology in a way where you are just starting from very neutral, unobjectionable principles and observations, and then try to work to God from there. It's hard to do, but yeah, I mean, that's the whole tradition of natural theology. But I don't really make the distinction between methodological naturalism and other kinds of naturalism. I don't know why. I don't have like an argument against it. I just never find myself using that phrase. I just, I don't know. I think everyone, you know, using the kind of like that approach, you know, this kind of, the approach that you're outlining, you know, that you're calling like a naturalist approach, like, I think that's open to anyone, because it's more of like an epistemic thesis about how we should figure out what's true. You know, and I think religious people often have like additional things, but I don't think anyone really denies that like evidence and reason is important, or that we should generally use that to, you know, I actually don't know any like fideists who say like, yeah, I just believe this on faith, and like, I believe because it's absurd to believe, like, you know, it's yeah.
And I had a conversation with Mike Hummer, who's basically said the same thing, which is, so what's the point? You know, isn't everybody a methodological naturalist in a way? And I think that's probably true when it comes to philosophers or academics. But I think fideism is reasonably common in the wider world. So I've had plenty of conversations with religious people who will say, you know, it's not relevant whether or not there's evidence to support my view. You know, it is a pure article of faith. But yeah, I don't know what the stats might be on how prevalent that stance is, but it certainly seems to come across in many of the sort of anecdotal conversations I have, where, you know, you don't feel a rationale for, don't feel a need for a rationale or an evidence base to support a conclusion.
That's interesting, because I honestly don't know if I've ever met a person who said that. I mean, like, I don't know if it's like a cultural divide or something, but yeah. like I remember I brought on Philip Goff to talk about religious fictionalism, because he's a Christian, but he doesn't believe in like the traditional God or anything like it. And I just thought that was so weird. I mean, I thought it was, you know, legitimate. Like, there are secular Jews and everything. So I thought, yeah, oh, there could be secular Christians. So so I was like kind of defending his view. And then a couple listeners from like Western Europe and from Japan actually reached out, and they were just like, yeah, this is totally normal. Like, where I'm from, like, almost everyone I know who's a Christian is like this type of Christian. I was like, really? Like, I don't know anyone who says this. Like, I thought it was like a totally unique thing, but I think it might just be different in the US or something. I don't know, but yeah, everyone I know has reasons why they're a Christian, including myself when I was a Christian. Like, they were very bad reasons, like poorly thought out reasons, but I did have, you know, something resembling a design argument, something resembling a cosmological argument, but more so design.
Yeah.
Design has always been more interesting to me.
And I think maybe that becomes more meaningful, is that rather than talking about what this fideism over here or this natural methodological naturalism over here, it becomes more a question about what's the quality of your naturalism. You know, as we were talking about, do you start with the conclusions and then shape the evidence and the reasoning to support that, or do you do it the other way around? So it's more about the quality of naturalism. But I guess one of the reasons I quite like talking about a commitment to a methodological naturalism is at least it locks us into what hopefully can be a productive debate, because it's baked into naturalism that you have to be open to all of the evidence, not just the evidence you like, and you have to apply some form of rationale. It doesn't guarantee we'll agree, and you can still make mistakes, of course, but at least you're in some form of productive conversation rather than one that's, you know, completely dogmatic, at least in theory. But,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I totally agree with Bart Ehrman, who is saying, like, it sounds like he was advocating some kind of methodological naturalism, like, oh, I can't invoke miraculous explanations as a historian. And it's like, well, look, I don't know anything about what historians do, but it does seem like you shouldn't just start off assuming that Jesus didn't rise from the dead. Like, you should kind of be open to that in principle, even if you're a naturalist. Like, you should be open in principle to the idea that that happened and then examine the evidence. And if the evidence is lacking, which it is, then you can, you know, not accept that. But like, it would be irrational, I think, just to like reject in principle, like, no, I'm assuming ahead of time that this can't possibly be right. Like, that would be irrational, I think.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's a couple of things here. One is one thing that helps that you've hinted at there is, instead of it being, you know, belief or non-belief or, you know, I disregard that completely or accept it completely, it's more one of credences and sort of Bayesian approach, where you're open-minded and you accord your degree of credence with the weight of the evidence, which means you should at least be theoretically open-minded about totally crazy things. But I think the other thing is, part of the reason why I think maybe methodological and ontological naturalism often collapse together is because, in a sense, if you do find evidence of some supernatural phenomenon, almost by definition, it's then become natural because you've got some evidence for it. So that's another sort of strange, you know, if we did come across some evidence of a deity intervening in the world in some way we could detect, then I guess that deity has become in some sense, a natural phenomenon and is no longer really supernatural. So I don't know if it becomes a bit circular, but...
I don't know. I mean, I think it comes down to your idea of how concepts have their meaning, I guess. So like, I don't think there's really a great analysis of supernatural or natural, where it's like, here are the necessary and sufficient conditions of what natural means and what supernatural means. I think it just comes down to how people use the term. So like, when people talk about God, that's kind of that's like the quintessential example of something supernatural. Like, that's the paradigm case of something supernatural. So even if God existed and he intervened from time to time, like raising Jesus from the dead or something, then I wouldn't call him natural, just because that's not how people use the term, you know, for the same reason I wouldn't call a rock supernatural, you know, I wouldn't call God natural. But yeah, it does just kind of fall, like, if you don't share that kind of use theory view that I have about how words get their meaning, which basically just comes from usage, like in certain like linguistic communities, then yeah, I could see how that might follow. But I do think that a more useful division that I tend to invoke for divvying up kinds of naturalism, I do like to say that, oh, naturalism is just the view that nature exhausts concrete reality or something like that. There's only the natural world. So the natural world is kind of common ground, you know, between us and theists and pretty much everyone else. So sometimes when people say they don't know what naturalism means or naturalism doesn't make any predictions, it just seems like obviously wrong to me, because everyone knows what the natural world is, even if they can't provide a definition of it. I mean, that's how most terms actually are. Everyone knows what they mean. Everyone knows how to use them. But if you ask for like a perfect definition of them, then you can't, it's really, really hard to do, because that's not how words came about. We didn't like write down in a dictionary and then start using them. We started using them and tried to write them down in a dictionary.
Yeah, if you'll only use concepts that are perfectly defined, then good luck.
Yeah.
But as far as I'm aware, there pretty much aren't any.
Like, yeah, even
in maths you might struggle. But
yeah, maybe you could use like triangle or something. Like, you could have a couple like geometric concepts and a handful of other things. But Yeah, it would be a very, very short list. And I think that, you know, when you look at how kids acquire language, it's not like you teach kids like, okay, we're going to go through the dictionary now and we're going to run through some new words that you're going to like. That's not how they acquire language. They just acquire language by watching other people do it. So, I feel like my view of how words get their meaning is more in line with how people actually acquire language and how language actually developed. Some people, they seem to work from like, they just seem to grab the wrong end of the stick. I feel like they seem to think you can't use a term unless you have like a perfect conceptual analysis, you know, necessary and sufficient conditions, no counterexamples, and then you're allowed to use it. Then it's meaningful. And it's like, I don't think that's right at all. So natural and supernatural, I think that it's kind of like that. But I do think that naturalists typically, especially in philosophy, there are people who believe that science pretty much informs us as to what's real and like the elements of physical science. Like that's basically it. So that's like a very strict form of naturalism, but that's not a bad like starting point. It's like, okay, well, what's real is the stuff that science tells us about. And like that exhausts concrete reality. That's what naturalism means. And then there's a more like moderate form of naturalism. Like, okay, maybe there are, in addition to those concrete things that science tells us about, there are all these abstract objects, you know, like propositions or like non-natural, like moral truths or something. And then there are liberal naturalists who add more things to their ontology, like some concrete stuff that most naturalists would not get on board with. But you're still not going for anything that people typically call supernatural, like gods or angels or heaven or you know, a prayer or something like that. It's like you're still recognizably a naturalist, in part because, you know, you're still an atheist or an agnostic. In philosophy of religion, that's like a big part of what naturalism means. It's just that you're an atheist or an agnostic. Whereas outside of philosophy of religion, it seems to be more concerned with like you believe in the things that science tells us about and not really much else, at least when it comes to the concrete world. So Philippe Leon uses this organization where you've got like naturalists, you've got moderate naturalists, and then you've got liberal naturalists. So the conservative naturalists are the ones who it's just like, it's just the stuff that science tells us about that exhausts all of reality. The moderate naturalists, they believe in that as well, but they think that there are some abstracta in addition to that. And then the liberal naturalists, they add even more stuff to their ontology. And I'm more in that category. You know, like I self-deprecatingly call myself a spooky naturalist because I believe in all these things that most naturalists think are just kind of like spooky or like paranormal even. And I'm just, so it started off as kind of like, you know, a joke, but now I actually kind of like the term. that's kind of how I view naturalism. You know, it does help to start talking about science first, I guess. And like, okay, here's what we know from science. Is that all there is? Like, is John Carroll right that like the core theory exhausts all of, you know, our everyday world and there's nothing over and above, you know, this equation that we can put on a whiteboard? And then you can kind of move farther and farther away from that into like liberal naturalism.
Thank you. That's been fascinating. Well, you've enriched my understanding of the different varieties of naturalism, but you've also reassured me that it's okay to keep using naturalism as one of the two tenets of sentientism, even though it's fuzzy and pluralistic. But I like that. That's one of the reasons I like it. So cool. We'll come back to some of the spooky stuff a bit later on as well. But let's move on to this second equally big question of what matters. So for many people who've moved to a naturalistic way of understanding the world, it's often a challenge to us is, okay, well, if you don't have a supervening deity or a religious book or, you know, some other set of rules, and you're not going to get punished or rewarded at some point for your behavior, you know, presumably you have no ethical grounding whatsoever and you're a total nihilist. So what's been your journey about, I guess, the grounding of ethics, if you do think there is one, and how did that shift as you moved from a young earth creationist ethic, which I presume was where you started, and what's the basis of your, how do you think about ethics now?
Yeah. I mean, I did kind of fall for a lot of the Christian propaganda about morals being sort of, that belongs to religion. And if you leave religion, then you have no morals. Like those are the two options. Either, you know, morality is real and objective, or you're an atheist and you're some kind of nihilist. So I did kind of fall for that, you know.
And was that part of the psychological difficulties you had in moving away from? Yeah.
Yeah, it was, because I had to, it's like I had to be so disillusioned and so like angry almost that I didn't care about the nihilism, where I was just like, okay, look, this is true. And it does have these awful implications, but I think it happens to be true. So what am I supposed to do about this? Like, yeah, nihilism. Okay, fine. But that was pretty short-lived, because I think that moral nihilism is like one of the least plausible positions that you could name. Like when you just start listing like the implications of nihilism, it's like, it has nothing to do with whether or not God exists. It's just the claims of nihilism are like as obviously false as anything you could name. Like just the idea that like the Holocaust wasn't bad, like in every sense, it just wasn't bad. And they say, oh, but I don't think it was good either. Okay, but you also think it wasn't bad. And it seems like it seems like it was bad to me, at least. Like, so when you're watching like Schindler's List, like, is it impossible for you to tell who the good guys were and who the bad guys were? Like, that's just totally incoherent.
There's just no fact of the matter. Yeah.
There's no fact of the matter. Yeah. Like just the idea that, you know, slavery wasn't bad. The Holocaust wasn't bad. Suffering is not bad. Pain, or I mean like pleasure, is not good. You know, like killing, you know, like kidnapping someone's infant and throwing it off of a building is just as good as caring for an infant and nurturing it, which is to say neither of them are good. Neither of them are bad. Neither of them are good. They're completely morally equivalent actions. That's so, like, it's hard. It's actually hard to think of something that's less plausible than what I just said. And again, it has nothing to do with whether or not God exists. It's just, it's self-evident that it's wrong. I don't understand how there are people who are actually like error theorists or nihilists or anything. So I did buy into that for like a short time, because I just thought that people like William Lane Craig were right, that like, look, if God doesn't exist, then you have no basis for saying that anything is wrong. And I was like, you know, so I bit the bullet for a short time, and then I was like, why would I, you know, so I moved away from that pretty quickly. It didn't take long to shake that off. It's sad to see that some people are still kind of under that illusion, including atheists, who seem to think that they have to be moral anti-realists as like a matter of consistency. Another wrinkle to this is that people like Craig are divine command theorists, which is a form of moral subjectivism, which is one of their big boogeymen. Like, oh no, moral subjectivism, you know, cultural relativism. And then they buy into this idea where morals constitutively depend on this subject. You know, so it's not a normal form of subjectivism, but they think that morals are grounded in the, you know, attitudes, opinions, feelings, whatever, of this subject, God. You know, that's what morals are. And if you get rid of God, then there are no morals.
Yeah, which has worrying implications if that God designed and built the hell where billions of innocents will burn in hell. Yeah, that gives you worrying implications about what benevolence and the good even mean if when you are actually supposed to follow that example.
Yes, yeah, I mean, those things are good. No, I mean, on divine command theory, that's perfectly good. There's nothing wrong with that at all, with this kind of like, you know, somewhat caricatured view, but it does happen to be held by millions and millions of like evangelical Christians, and also by non-Christians as well, that like you are literally going to burn, you know, in the afterlife if you fail to accept the right propositions or something. You know, so there's nothing morally wrong with that on their like divine command theoretic view, which is kind of like a reductio maybe that of that view. But fortunately, there are other arguments. But yeah, it's just kind of ironic to me that one of their boogeymen is, you know, moral subjectivism. And it's like, they are moral subjectivists. They're not the, you know, typical kind where it's like, you're a moral subject, I'm a moral subject, and like, it's just relative between us or something. But yeah, they think there's only one moral subject that really matters, you know, that sets the standard. But it's still, ultimately, they're grounding morals in this. They're saying that morals constitutively depend on this subject. You know, that's what makes it a form of subjectivism. Whereas I'm not a moral subjectivist. I believe that morality is objective. So unlike divine command theorists, I believe that morality is objective. So it's sort of grounded in these, you know, non-natural moral truths that we don't observe, but they sort of have a similar status as like logical truths or like mathematical truths. So I'm what's called an ethical non-naturalist. I think that, you know, morality is real and objective. There are right and wrong answers to moral questions. You know, the Holocaust was bad. It doesn't matter how anyone feels about it. Like, it just was bad. You know, it doesn't matter if the Nazis had won, it was still bad. You know, suffering is not good. You know, that's a fact. And it doesn't matter how anyone reacts to it, including God. You know, suffering just is bad. And not even all theists are divine command theorists. Like, a lot of the theists would agree with me, actually. They would be ethical, not naturalists. And they think that these moral truths obtain in all possible worlds. And God is just, you know, he's not really the source of them, I guess, in the same way that he's not really the source of abstract objects like, you know, logical truths or mathematical truths. Obviously, theists fall on both sides of every question that you could possibly raise. But I'm just saying plenty of theists do believe that, you know, they reject divine command theory and they think that moral truths are kind of independent of God. Like morality would be objectively, like morality would be real and objective regardless of whether or not God existed. And that's, you know, also my opinion. So they don't have any issue with like Euthyphro's dilemma where you say, you know, does God have moral reasons for what he's doing or does he not have moral reasons for what he's commanding? You know, so either he has moral reasons for what he's commanding for his divine commands and there's some kind of moral truth independent of God that's informing his commands. So that's the option that they would happily take. You know, the non-divine command theorists are like, yeah, God, like it's God is commanding it because it's good, you know, and then the divine command theorists would be more likely to say, well, it's only good because God commands it. And if God didn't exist, there wouldn't be any right and wrong, you know, so, you know, but then that just makes everything morally arbitrary because God doesn't have moral reasons for his commands. So he's just issuing these morally arbitrary commands. And obviously we shouldn't follow morally arbitrary commands. So yeah, I do believe in objective morals is the long and short of it.
Yeah. Thank you. And I, again, I'm a total amateur in this space, but I find the concepts of this moral realism versus anti-realism quite interesting. And I guess where I am is that I'm not a moral realist in the sense that I don't think morality and ethics existed before sentient beings existed. I don't think there's any sort of primordial ordeal, sort of Platonic truth floating out there, but contingent on the existence of sentient beings that experience suffering by definition as negative and flourishing as by definition positive, then that's as real as you need. I'm not sure whether that makes me a realist or an anti-realist of some variety or how that fits in, but.
Well, it's not clear based on what you just said. You kind of sound like you might be a moral naturalist, which is a realist position.
Right.
You might think that, you know, there are right and wrong answers to moral questions, you know, like the flourishing of sentient creatures is good. And, you know, the languishing of sentient creatures is bad. Yeah. Like that's just a fact. Like, so I don't know if that's what you would say, but if you think it's ultimately grounded in these sort of natural facts, I guess, you know,
yeah.
I know that you think consciousness is like ultimately just a matter of information processing, which can be described like physically. And yeah, I mean, I guess one question would be whether or not you think that these moral truths are totally reducible to descriptive truth. So like these evaluative statements about, you know, pleasure is good or pain is bad or something like that. Do you think that that's reducible to purely descriptive claims? Like, are these evaluative claims like reducible to descriptive claims about how the world is, you know, things that physical science can tell us about? So I think that would, you know, definitely clear it up. If that would make you a moral naturalist, I think.
Yeah. I think that's probably where I am. Cause I think, and again, sentientists disagree on this as well as most other topics, but personally, yeah, I think you can reduce it down to the descriptive facts about what it means to be a sentient being and the fact that that entity experiences things with a certain valence links directly to, you know, the moral thinking we might do about that. So experiences of good and bad ultimately link very closely to what morally good and bad outcomes are. But yeah, so that's helpful. Thank you. Yeah.
No. Yeah. And I'm not a moral naturalist. I'm a moral non-naturalist. So I think we would agree on most things. And I'm not sure you're a moral naturalist, by the way, but it just sounds like you might be. But
I need to read some more.
But I think that these evaluative claims are not totally reducible to descriptive claims. Like if you're familiar with like the is-ought gap, you know, that's a good like first approximation of what I'm getting at here. Like, I just don't think you can really get from descriptive claims to evaluative claims, like from is to ought. So that's not like the total reason why I'm a non-naturalist, but you know, that's a good like first approximation of why. Is like, I don't think that these evaluative claims are like totally reducible to descriptive claims. But I still think that there are right and wrong answers. And, you know, I think that it sounds like you're a you know, like an empiricist, like a hardcore empiricist. Even when you were saying, when you're kind of describing like what non-naturalism would sort of be like, where you're like, oh, there are these, you know, moral truths floating out there, you know? So like, even that, it's like, you're thinking like spatio-temporally, like, oh, where would they be?
Yeah,
and like, it's just absurd to you that like, so I mean, that's like a very empiricist frame of mind, you know, of like, well, I can't observe them. You know, where are they? And it, for me, it's like, well, I don't think they're any, I don't think they're spatiotemporally located. I don't think that we know about them on the basis of observation. Like, I think we know about these moral truths through a rational intuition, which is also something that empiricists will not love.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we do kind of like intuit these moral truths. Like, we know about moral truths on the basis of intuition. Like, there are some certain foundational moral truths that are just obvious. They're just self-evident. And we can kind of work from those to more complex places. And then it gets very murky. And then there's all this really complicated moral disagreement where it's not obvious at all what the right answer is. But there are certain things, foundational things that are obvious, like suffering is bad. Like, I'm pretty confident of that. but yeah, I think that we just rationally intuit the fact that suffering is bad. We don't like really observe that it's bad. We just can see that it's bad, you know, like not through empirical observation, like just intellectually, intuitively. It's like, well, yeah, it's as obvious as like 2 + 2 = 4.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of in the definition of the word itself, again, coming back to the idea of fuzzy concepts before, it's sort of, yeah, difficult to describe how else it could work. And you can, of course, have all sorts of conversations about, you know, justified suffering and whether suffering is a necessary part of a broader flourishing life and so on. But intrinsically, in itself, it strikes me as definitionally true that suffering itself is a negative valenced experience. But yeah.
No, I would recommend, I've been reading this book called Ethical Intuitionism by Michael Humer. And yeah. I would highly recommend it for anyone who is interested in the conversation we're having right now, instead of thinking like, what is the point of this philosophical yammering? But I just have totally, like, I love this kind of stuff, you know? So, but if people are more interested, then yeah, that's the book that I've been reading that would go more into depth on all these different meta-ethical views.
Thank you. Yeah, I was lucky to have him as a previous guest as well. It was a fascinating, mind-bending conversation too. Yeah, no, I'll look it up. So that's been really helpful answering that question of, you know, what matters and how might you sort of ground a view of ethics. But there's an equally important question that's related in ethics as to who matters. So I think many people of different ways of thinking about ethics would acknowledge that in some sense, morality is about our concern for some sort of concern for others. You know, if you don't have a completely relativistic or nihilistic approach or a supernatural approach, there's something about whether and how we care for others. And the follow-up question is, okay, which others? So again, many of my guests have had a really interesting journey here where they've started out from some sort of default scope of moral consideration that, you know, they got from their family and society around them and how that's changed over time. So it'd be interesting to know your journey on that front too. And one of the critical breakpoints really is about the human and the non-human, but I'm interested in the broader story too, of course. So.
Yeah. See, this is the part that I've kind of been dreading a little bit because I'm like, I have like vegan moral principles, I guess, but I'm not really like a consistent vegan. Like I've reduced my consumption of animal products of all kinds by like conservatively like 90%.
Yeah.
You know, like it's been like way, way reduced, but, you know, dramatically reduced, but still, you know, I'm not like totally, like I don't totally abstain from all animal products or even from meat sometimes. Usually it's because someone else buys it for me. You know, or like it's already been paid for, so it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm not like, you know, kind of like a purist about it. I'm not like, I'm usually not disgusted by, like animal products. Like sometimes I am, like, even when I was younger, before I had any vegan thought, like floating in my head, I couldn't eat ribs. Like, I think I've had ribs maybe twice in my life,
yeah.
You know, because they're ribs. Like
I just clearly remember, part of the anatomy of that. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just remember like, we were at like a steakhouse or something and I was like 15 and I was just like, I can't, like, I could barely stomach it. So I was like, these are just ribs. Like, I can't pretend, there's no pretending that this is not just like this, that, you know, side of a torso of like a, of an animal.
Yeah.
And, you know, something that, you know, I was not right. Like, veganism was not something that was taken seriously. I had no idea why people even thought that, why they should do that when I was younger. But I remember, you know, I started becoming sort of more sensitive to like animal rights issues, you know, as you become like dimly more and more aware of factory farming and you're like, that's not justifiable. Even if you're not a vegan or a vegetarian, like participating in factory farming is morally unjustifiable. Like it's just, it's animal cruelty on like a scale that, you know, I mean, it's hard to overstate like how evil factory farming actually is. Yeah. And like when I see some of these vegans who are like clearly very morally alarmed by it, and then people will either make fun of them or treat it like they're kind of being hysterical. It does make me very angry. I understand why a lot of vegans react the way they do. And it's hard not to, I've actually been banned from Twitter one time because I was speaking my mind about someone who's doing this, you know. It's hard not to get angry when people are diminishing and trivializing the very real, very terrible suffering of like trillions and trillions of sentient beings. But what was a major turning point, I think I was like 19 or 20, and Ricky Gervais, of all people, I heard someone say to him like, oh, if you love animals so much, then why do you eat them? And he was like, I don't. And I don't know, just he said it so like dispassionately and like matter of factly, like, oh, if you like someone challenging him, if you like animals, why do you eat them? He's like, I don't. And I was like, yeah, you know, that makes sense. If you like animals, then don't eat them. Like, it just seems like so
pretty straightforward.
Like, yeah. I mean, once I saw it, I couldn't really unsee it. It's like, cause I always have loved animals. And then it's like, well, then why do you eat them? It's like, oh yeah, that is not something that I should do if I like animals. So not all vegans are like animal lovers, but I do love animals. And if you like animals, then don't eat them. It's as simple as that. That kind of broke something in me.
And you mentioned the disgust factor, and that's really fascinating because for some people, the disgust can actually be the trigger. It can be the first thing, you know, and I've spoken to many people who, you know, when they're at, you know, 10, 11, sometimes even earlier than that, when the light went on and they realized what was on their plate was actually flesh or, so on. And it's the disgust was the start, and that triggered them into thinking about the ethics. For me, and, you know, I had a long, long journey on this thing as well. So I've been probably vegetarian for, I went vegetarian in my mid-20s, which is many decades ago now, and I've been vegan for like 5 or 6 years. So there's maybe a 20-year gap between vegetarian and vegan. And there's no perfection here either. I mean, no one lives a life without causing harm, but I still think it's a meaningful step to say that and to, you know, make the effort to exclude animal products. So I did that a few years ago. But for me, the disgust came afterwards. So it was after the thinking and the ethics and the, you know, the other stuff. And now I think the disgust has sort of set in as a response to that rather than the other way around. Yeah. But yeah, you were saying that was the sort of thing that sort of was the turning point, at least in the sort of ethical stance, if you like.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I did feel disgusted with animal products for like a year after I became vegetarian, I would say, like, but then that kind of faded, you know, and like I said, I'm not really disgusted by it most of the time, except when people talk about, babies, like when people are like, oh, do you want lamb? Like, oh, do you want veal? Like, that's when I'm just like, what the fuck is wrong with you? Like, that's the one time where I'm actually just like, I don't understand. Like, I don't think I've ever eaten like baby animals, to my knowledge.
Yeah.
Like I never have, I never will. Like I have no, like that is one area where I'm actually like, yeah, what's wrong with you? Like, why are you even talking about eating like baby animals? Like, even for someone who sees no problem with eating animals, like how do you not have an issue with that at least? So yeah, but other than that, I don't really feel disgust. Like I said, I can eat animal products without feeling disgust. I try not to think about where it came from, but yeah.
Yeah. And I think I find it a fascinating subject in some ways, for parallel reasons with the religious naturalism, supernaturalism topic, because there's almost this battle going on between these extremely powerful, domineering social norms that tell you a certain set of things are right and true and ethically acceptable. And then I think you'd largely agree, a process of working through with humility, but using evidence and reason and compassion to try and come to a conclusion that is starkly dissonant with those social norms. And it feels like quite often in the conversations I have with my guests, there's this parallel between, you know, trying to use that evidence, reason and compassion to break out of those very painful social norms, both on the naturalism front and on this stance about taking non-human animals seriously.
Yeah.
And it is really difficult because, like you say, I think most people who even consume animal products, there's some really interesting survey work that shows that I think roughly half of US citizens, the Sentience Institute did some surveys that showed that about half of people who consume animal products would, you know, are viscerally against factory farming, and a similar proportion would actually want to see a ban in slaughterhouses. You know, those people clearly hadn't thought through the implications of that for their decisions. And things like with, you know, as you say, baby animals, again, there's a latent ethics, even amongst the people who still consume animal products, that I think are triggers and weighs in. And the difficulty is often that those maybe the most egregious problems in the animal agriculture industry are used to set in contrast maybe slightly less egregious practices, which are still, I think, deeply ethically sickening. But in contrast with the factory farm, the family farm doesn't seem so bad until you then look at the practices that are going on there and realize that the worst parts of the factory farm process are happening in the family farm as well. So it's a really fascinating moral space, because I guess you can get to a point of clarity of just condemning the entire enterprise in general, subject to sort of just transition through it. But it's fascinating to see which parts of that, you know, the social norms stick and which things are egregious enough to break through. It's an interesting space.
Yeah. Now, I mean, what do you think about those like happy farms, you know, like the ones where it's like, oh, our animals live like a normal life. You know, they have pasture space. Like they're not crowded. They're not like given any weird hormones or anything. Like, cause a lot of these people, it's not just animal ethics concerns. It's also, they're concerned about other things, you know, like more natural food or like less unhealthy stuff, whatever. Like it's usually wrapped up with like four or five different concerns, and like animal ethics is sometimes thrown in there, you know, but I mean, what do you think about some of these places that claim to say like, oh, you know, these animals, like they live normal lives, they live good lives, you know, until the last day. But up until that point, you know, like, I mean, that seems like on the face of it, more defensible. It doesn't really seem like you can't really scale that up. You know, not everyone could do that.
Yeah. But, you know. I think maybe the most insidious thing about the existence of that type of animal farming is that it allows people to believe that that's where their products are coming from while they continue to buy from factory farms. So that's largely what the surveys play out. You know, vast proportions of people say, I'm viscerally against factory farming and I never buy from it. You know, I only buy from the happy family farms. But in the US, 99% of animal products come from factory farms. So, you know, something doesn't work out in the math. So I think there's something behaviorally that worries me about those, because it gives people an excuse that enables them basically not to make any change at all. I think there's an environmental aspect to them as well, which ironically, because the CAFOs and the industrial factory farms are driven for super efficiency, horrific efficiency, per, you know, gram of protein or calories, a happy family organic free-range farm is actually more environmentally destructive than an intensive farm. So that's another challenge to those models. And I certainly agree that they would not scale. So at the moment, you know, if you went from our current agricultural system to a completely plant-based one, you could free up 75% of agricultural land. It's like two continents. But if you were to do the opposite and say, let's take the intensive animal farms and make them all free-range, you'd need to basically turn over, I think, the entire planet to animal agriculture. And we're not far off that already. So I think there's that challenge. But the most important thing for me is the ethical stance. And I think there, the core of it is really to take the perspective of, you know, the other, the victim in the process. And I think you're right. You know, if I was given the choice, you can live in a factory farm or you can live in a family farm, you know, I know which will be the lesser of two evils. But at the same time, even in those nice family farms, you know, families are separated. They're essentially sexually abused for artificial insemination. There's still mutilation practices that are used. But even if you strip all of that out, ultimately you're still killing a sentient being, taking it away from its family for relatively trivial reasons. So I agree you can sort of grade degrees of horror. But as soon as you switch to think about, you know, the perspective of the other and the victim in these stances, I end up in an extremely strict sort of line, even in the nicest animal agriculture. I just think, yeah, we need a transition to end the whole thing.
Yeah. Yeah. As soon as you bring in the environmental concerns, it's like, yeah, you just have to go vegan. Like there's really no way around it.
There's
like,
no way. And I've argued before that, you know, even if someone has an explicitly anthropocentric worldview, where only humans matter, the arguments for veganism are still completely overwhelming. you know, even if you really don't care about non-human animals at all. And I think I say that with a straight face, right? The level of the challenges we've got with pollution and zoonosis and emissions and water use and land use, it's one of the craziest things we could ever imagine doing. And I tweeted recently, I said, look, if animal agriculture didn't exist, what reasons would you give for starting it? And it was like tumbleweed, right? This is a crazy thing to be doing. But if I pull you back to the philosophy, because the other thing I don't really want to do in these things is sort of audit my guests' personal lives and so on. There's no perfection here. You know, people are working
No, I'm trying to come clean. I'm trying to be like, I feel like as a matter of consistency, I have to be like, okay, I've only reduced by like a huge amount, but still it's not like I'm a purely vegan person or purely vegetarian, but you know, at least my kitchen is like vegetarian and like for the most part vegan. The problem, I don't want to put my wife on blast here, but like it would be a vegan kitchen were it not for my wife. But she's trying to get me into one of these like happy farms that like is near Ann Arbor where we live. And you know, we're looking at it online and stuff, and like I'm like obviously we're gonna go there and look at it, but it seemed like it was pretty much on the up and up based on what this is like a one family farm. This is not like a, you know, a chain or anything. And the main thing that I see so far that's disturbing to me is that they do offer like milk, you know, and like how there's no way around the way that you have to get milk, you know, like
this pregnancy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, you do have to like separate the families, right? There's no way around that. So
no way around it.
Yeah. So it's just not worth it.
And this is the challenge, right? Because I've walked through and been around some of those farms, and you look at the marketing and you see the idyllic fields and the happy cows and so on. But that's the thing. They won't show you the artificial insemination process. They won't show you the calf separation, and they won't take you around the slaughterhouse either. And most of the farmers won't even go to the slaughterhouse. That's one reason they tend to outsource it, is because they don't want to do it themselves. Quite often the farmers would develop quite an attachment to their own.
Well, I mean, part of this was conditional on me being able to see all those things. So if they don't even let me tour those things, then I'm definitely
That'd be interesting. It'd be interesting to hear. Yeah, no, but I appreciate the honesty and let me know how that goes. Yeah.
And I definitely don't, obviously it can't be scaled, but it's not a solution that's like good for the long-term or for like the bigger scale. With the solution for the bigger scale is just lab grown meat or, you know, some kind of like fake meat that's indistinguishable from the real thing, which I think we're well on our way to having like fake meat that is like indistinguishable from real meat.
I completely agree. And the only reason we need those is human preferences, really, because we can get everything we need from pure plants. Mm-hmm. But I agree. I think it's a combination of, you know, the plant, classic plant agriculture, but also plant-based stuff, which is already getting awesomely good. And ultimately the cultured meat, I think that's the sort of combination that's going to turn it around. And I think, the other thing, you know, unfortunately, you know, YouTube's and podcasts and ethical argument work quite slowly on the human mind. Whereas if you can make something fast, cheap, easy, and socially acceptable, you know, change can happen quickly. So
that's what'll do it. Is once we have fake meat stuff that is indistinguishable from real meat, which we already do have in like chicken sandwiches. Like if you have like the vegan equivalent of a McChicken is like better or indistinguishable from like the fast food chicken sandwich. But eventually everything will get to that point, and it will be cheaper, I think, eventually, because you don't have to like raise a whole animal and then kill it and then just take the part of it that you want. You'll be able to just make the part that you want. So in theory, it should eventually be cheaper. And then once people have a cheaper product that's just as good, they'll buy that. And then the use of factory farm, now that it's not so inconvenient and they don't have to really give anything up, people will actually stop using factory farms, and then we can ban it once it becomes less and less popular. But that's the realistic path. I mean, not to skip ahead to the better future part of the episode, but that's like one of the only, that does seem kind of realistic to me. Like, I don't think that's beyond the realm of possibilities at all. And that would actually be a really positive development. But in the absence of, you know, like fake meat stuff that's just as good, then it will just never happen, you know. So like that's why I just want to like like wring vegans by the neck who want to like, who are like opposed to fake meat or lab grown meat or something. I'm like, this is the way that it stops. Like, this is the way we stop factory farming.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not about, you know, veganism isn't about the vegans, it's about the non-human animals. So mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah, and we might come back to some of those topics later on. And I totally agree on, even if you put the ethics to one side, this sheer inbuilt inefficiency of animal agriculture is absolutely mind-blowing. You know, as soon as you learn about that land use scale, and as soon as you learn about how much of human edible crops are fed to animals, and as soon as you learn about feed conversion ratios, you know, you need to put 23 times the amount of calories into a cow to get one calorie, or, you know, come and see numbers. But the ratio of, and the waste, nearly all of that is basically turned to blood, sweat, heat, you know, energy loss. It's catastrophically wasteful, yeah. So I agree. I think some of those other factors will help, and we can keep chipping away at the ethics as well in the meantime. But if I drag you back to the theory, there's an implication there that your moral consideration, I would assume, includes all humans, but it, at least in theory, would include non-human animals. And do you think about that in the context of sentience? Do you care about non-human animals because of their capacity to suffer and flourish? Would you say that sentience is what guides you there, or is there something else?
I definitely care about all humans. They're all like morally equivalent. I don't actually care about all humans, but they're morally equivalent.
Yeah.
Same for non-human animals. Yeah, sentience is ultimately what I care about. I'm kind of open-minded to whether there are other things that matter morally. Like, I used to be pretty strict. I used to be pretty attracted to utilitarianism, like in a pretty strict form, like hedonic act utilitarianism. And now I'm a little bit more of a pluralist, or you might say like a particularist. Like, I don't think there are these very simple moral principles that can be stated in a sentence and then like that actually can explain everything that we think is right and wrong. Like, so that's why I don't really accept utilitarianism anymore, even though sometimes I say like I caucus with the utilitarians because I end up agreeing with them like most of the time, like certainly more than like natural law theorists who think that like, you know, oral sex is demonic. And like, you know, you've got other like natural law theorists like Tim How, or I can't pronounce his last name, but he wrote a paper defending factory farms, like saying factory farms are actually good. And I think he's a natural law theorist. So, you know, if you're comparing like, you know, the critiques of different normative theories that people put out there, like, well, on the other hand, on one hand, we have natural law theorists who think that oral sex is morally wrong and who are defending factory farming. On the other hand, we have Peter Singer, who's perhaps a little insensitive about disability and thinks that it's, you know, morally justified to abort fetuses who will grow up to be severely disabled. So if you can't tell which one of those is worse, then I think you might be morally kind of like stunted or something. Like, one of those is obviously not. So yeah, I mean, I agree with utilitarians like 90%+ of the time, and with like sentientists like 90%+ of the time. So even if I'm technically not a utilitarian or a sentientist, I'm like going to be on the same side as them pretty much all of the time. It's just, I think there might be other things that matter besides sentience.
Yeah. And often sentientism is associated with utilitarianism just because of people like Peter Singer and others who've gone down that path. But I think I've tried to position it as much more pluralistic than that. So I think that, and you know, I've spoken to deontologists, I've spoken to feminist care ethics of people, I've spoken to people have a, you know, a sort of modernized a Kantian view like Christine Korsgaard, who extends that to non-human animals. So I think as long as your moral consideration includes all sentient beings, you can still apply lots of different ethical systems to that. You don't have to follow a utilitarian approach. So I quite like that pluralism. And I'm also open to the idea that sentience might not be the only thing that matters. So I've tried to frame sentientism as insisting that every sentient being gets to be included, but it doesn't necessarily say that sentience is the only thing that matters. And it doesn't necessarily say that you couldn't extend it beyond that if you want to. The most important thing is that we don't exclude any sentient beings. So I've had conversations with people like Susanna Monzo and others who talked about whether dignity or autonomy or there might be some other things that could be factors that have their own independent moral weight. I tend to be quite a strict sentientist in that whenever I think about those other things, I think, yes, they're important because of the way they impact on the quality of my sentient experience. So whether that's, you know, I'm doing that in appropriately or not, or whether I'm just obsessed with this idea of sentience, I don't know. But I'm quite open to the idea there's more.
No, I think that's reasonable. I just think there are some counterexamples, and not many, by the way, but I just think there are a couple counterexamples to that view where when you're trying to, I mean, I know I'm thinking about this like a utilitarian, but it's like doing the best for sentient creatures, like maximizing like positively charged hedonic experiences and like minimizing experiences with a negative valence. There are a few circumstances where that intuitively seems like the wrong thing to do. In almost every circumstance, it seems like the right thing to do. But there are a couple, you know, to go back to Michael Humer again, like he raises like several objections to utilitarianism where it's like, it seems like the right thing to do is not the thing that maximizes good experiences and minimizes bad experiences for sentient beings. And they're unusual, but it's like, that's all you really need as a counterexample, you know? So I am kind of convinced by that. That's why I'm more of like a pluralist slash particularist, because I don't think everything comes down to just, you know, it, like adding up the qualitative experiences of sentient beings. Even though that's pretty good. Like that's a pretty, I mean, you're going to get to the right answer like 99% of the time if that is what you think. Yeah.